This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What would you say if I told you there's a book that can teach you how to win The Bachelor?
What would you say if I told you producers caught multiple finalists reading that book in this season that's currently airing?
What would you say if I told you the producers don't want anyone to know that their show has been compromised?
How do we know all this? We wrote that book.
I'm Lizzie Pace.
And I'm Chad Colchin.
We're the authors of How to Win the Bachelor and the hosts of the Game of Roses podcast, a biweekly podcast where we break down all the biggest plays, errors, and MVPs in the game of reality television.
Listen to Game of Roses wherever you get your podcasts and go to howtowinthebachelor.com to get our book.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hi, it's Dave here. This is my wife, Kathy.
Hello.
This is The Cinemile, the podcast where we used to walk home from the movies, but now they're not open. So what are we doing instead, Kathy?
So tonight...
Tell them what they've won.
We're very excited to be actually renting a blockbuster. Wonder Woman 84 is out today in the UK on demand. It was out last month in the cinemas very briefly. We missed it. It's out in the States on HBO Max. But it's been a long time coming. It was supposed to be out last summer. It was delayed. You know, there is a global pandemic going on.
But we don't get it for free with a streaming platform. We get it for the cushy price of £16.99.
Yeah, which we have no qualms about paying.
For a rental.
We're very excited. And if you think about
We'll pay anything.
A trip to the cinema would actually cost us way more than that.
Oh, yeah, sure. Sadly, and this is as close as we're going to get to the cinema. Yeah. I just feel like this feels like movie night. It feels like date night
tonight. I'm actually genuinely excited. Like, I feel like... we're going to put the time aside for it. The kids will be in bed. We'll have some wine.
Will we have some wine? Let's have some wine.
And because we both, like, absolutely loved the first Wonder Woman movie.
Yeah, it was good fun. Gal Gadot was, like, absolutely brilliant as Wonder Woman. Good chemistry with Chris Pine.
Yeah.
Lovely fish out of water comedy.
Love a World War One story.
And I had that real superhero vibes when she, like, steps out in the trenches of World War One. You're like, she's a real superhero.
It was really good. And I thought Patty Jenkins did a brilliant job as a director. And we're pumped. And we're going to have a very special guest joining us. So usually when we've guests reviewing films with us, what we do is great fun. We'll go meet them for a drink or food or something. Catch up, then we'll go to the cinema, then we'll all go for a walk and chat about the movie.
It's a great way to meet people.
It's a lovely way to meet people. Alas, it's now not possible.
No, it's illegal.
It's illegal to do that right now.
So we will be dialing in to Amon Warman from Empire Magazine and various other prestigious media establishments, magazines, you could say.
Yeah, so when we've all watched the movie, we're going to reconvene and chat online about it. So you'll hear him when we come back after this. But before we do, Dave is going to say a thank you to some of our latest subscribers to our Patreon feed. That's patreon.com/thecinemile, where we review retro movies every month and a ton and ton of TV shows, including most recently Bridgerton and The Mandalorian.
Yeah. So thank you to Matt, to Nick, to Tim Hopkin, to Stephen, Nunn, to Megan Walsh, Graham Betts, Lee Currid, Mike Willoughby and Dick McGee.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much for joining. And we've had many more new people in January. We'll shout you out in a later episode.
Yeah.
So thank you to all of you for joining at the rate of $2 or $3 a month.
Now, let's get these kids to bed and get Wonder Woman 84 on.
Yes. See you on the other side.
Bye.
Bye.
Citizens of the world, I'm here to change your life. Anything.
anything you dream of, you can have it.
You look like you saw a ghost. Diana, look at you. It's like not one day has passed.
I don't want to be like anyone. I want to be an apex predator. You've always had everything, while people like me have had nothing. Well, now it's my turn. Get used to it.
Right, we're back. We have watched Wonder Woman 1984 or 84. I don't know what it's called. It's one or the other. And we are now joined by Amon Warman, or Wonder Warman, as he's named himself in the chat here. So massive kudos for that. Welcome, Amon.
Thank you for having me. Good to be here.
So, Amon, we watched this just now on our telly box and paid £17. How did you get to see it in the movies?
I got to see it at the IMAX, which was...
Oh, IMAX, top tier!
Yeah. No, it was crazy. Like, just to be back in the cinema among your colleagues, and obviously it wasn't a packed house because COVID, so it didn't quite fully replicate the feeling of a big multimedia screening, which I've been craving for a while, because I absolutely loved that atmosphere.
Yeah.
But it was on the morning screening at the IMAX, and just be back in that atmosphere. Like, literally, I was jumping up and down in my seat before the film had even started, because when you go to IMAX, they do this 10-1 countdown. When they started doing that, I was like, here we go, we're back! It felt so great. And I think off the back of that 10-1 countdown and the first 15 minutes of Wonder Woman 1984, which I think are fantastic, it was so awesome to be back in that atmosphere. Like, the film was on track to be 5 stars after that first 15-20 minutes or so.
You got to tell us then, Amon. So, what do you think of the other 2 hours and 15 minutes of this movie?
Yeah, it's not 5 stars. I'll tell you that, Dave. I'm a bit mixed on Wonder Woman 1984. Yes, I'm going to say the one he didn't say. I had fun with it. I enjoyed it. I think a lot of the action is pretty good. I love what she does with her lasso in this. I think it's so hard, especially when it comes to super action these days, to do something that's genuinely very innovative and fresh. But the things which they do with the lasso in this are really, really cool for the most part. So I like that. I think for the most part, the performances are really, really good. I think Hans Zimmer's score is fantastic. Hans Zimmer is one of my favorite composers of all time. His recent output, I wouldn't go as far as to say it's been hit and miss, but it hasn't really grabbed me in the way a magnificent Hans Zimmer score does. But this score is fantastic. Mm. And I made sort of a countdown list, as I do every year at the end of every year on Twitter, of my favorite film tracks of the year, and Hans Zimmer's Wonder Woman 1984 score was included in that because it's great. But there are issues with this movie, which really, you know.
Yeah, that's an understatement.
There are issues with this movie, and it's a shame. Because Wonder Woman 1984 was the film I was most excited to see this year. Like, even back when the first trailers were released, like, you know, 5,000 years ago now, I got really, really pumped. And, you know, I really liked the first one. And I was really chomping at the bit to watch this blockbuster, for months in advance. So I really wanted it to be fantastic and to exceed the first one, and it didn't quite do that for me, unfortunately.
Nice one. Oh, well, Cathy, I'll throw to you then next. So, are you in the same? Are you in the same boat? Disappointed? Well, I already know the answer. I don't know why I'm posing it like a question.
Well, I'm actually very similarly to Amon. We were only watching it at home on our sofa, and we were like, we were like shivering with excitement to watch this. We were so thrilled to have a new movie. We were like pumped, and we were like sitting in our living room on a Wednesday night. So I can't actually imagine what it would have felt like to be in IMAX. Like, we nearly died when we went to see Tenet last summer in the cinema.
I got goosebumps you just describing the top 10 countdown thing. I was like transported.
Yeah, because I didn't, that 10-1 countdown, they have like, you know, what's the phrase they have, like, you know, oh, I can't remember the phrase, but it's like, become part of the experience or be part of one, then it twists, and then the IMAX logo comes up. You've been to IMAX before, you know what it is. But it's just oh, yes, I'm back in my spiritual home.
Do you know what? I would pay 20 quid just to go sit in that seat and have the guy or girl come out and give the spiel about, like, welcome to IMAX, and then just leave. That would be enough for me.
I've always thought that I would be fantastic at that job.
It would be a nice job.
Well, yeah, it's a low bar.
I was thrilled when, like, the Sky Store rented home logo came off.
It's not the same.
Yeah, but interesting. No, it's not the same. But I did, for sure, I agree with you on, like, the opening. I thought the opening was class.
Yeah.
I love all the stuff set, like, in her homeland. And I think the act, like, I love Robin Wright, and, like, I love all that stuff. And, like, we're not going to do any spoilers yet, but, you know, similarly to the first movie, there's a lot done in her homeland at the beginning that I really like. And I think Gal Gadot is great. I think Christian Wiig is brilliant, right? And you see a bit of what happens to Christian Wiig in the trailer, so I'm not spoiling anything that's not in the trailer here, but she kind of...
I would say the trailer spoiled most of the movie.
Well, yeah, but that's not my fault. So
okay, well, just warning here, if you are sensitive to if you want to know nothing about the plot at all that's not in the trailer,
basically,
there's
like a bit of a Michelle Pfeiffer in Batman vibe going on with Christian Wiig that I loved. And also a bit of, like, Meryl Streep in Death Becomes Her. That's what I was getting from her, and I was living for that. So I love Kristen Wiig. After that...
That's a good reference.
What I was really surprised by was... Because I really, really loved the first movie. I was really surprised by... I thought both the script and the story of this film were much poorer. And I looked up afterwards, and you won't believe it, Dave, but...
Was it written by 20 people?
Well, the last one was screenplay by Alan Heinberg, but Zack Snyder worked on the story.
Yeah.
This time, the screenplay is by 3 people, which is always a bad sign. Patty Jenkins, Jeff Johns, and Dave Callenham, and story by Patty Jenkins and Jeff Johns. I don't know them. But isn't that so funny, because people are so down on Zack Snyder that he was involved in the last one, and Patty Jenkins...
He's a producer here, isn't he?
But he's not a writer. They're the only credits I noted. But yeah, this, I thought the script and the story were very messy. I thought Chris Pine... looked like, and I actually really like Chris Pine, think he's very attractive. They styled him in this movie like somebody's grandma has just gotten a perm, and I don't know why.
What?
I was very surprised by how Chris Pine looked in this movie.
I just have to interject
here. Where's Chris Pine in your Chris rankings? This is very important.
No, Chris Hemsworth is top, and actually Chris from Guardians of the Galaxy would have been second, except that I now know about his questionable beliefs in, like, being a hunter.
He's a hunter.
So he's gone down the bottom.
What about Chris O'Dowd?
Chris O'Dowd second, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Flag
for the Irish.
Yeah, right? Basically, Chris, Guardians of the Galaxy's bottom, Chris Hemsworth's top. Chris Pine's hair is bad, though.
Chris Pine is a handsome, handsome man, and he's very charming, and you lay off his hair.
Dave, we're not done with this. Where's Chris Evans in this? Where's Captain America in this?
Oh, Captain America would be third after Chris O'Dowd.
Kathy, get your shit together, right? Sort out your Chris list. Don't come to this podcast prepared.
Hemsworth, Pine, O'Dowd, Evans?
No. Hemsworth, O'Dowd, Evans, Pine.
Okay.
Guardians of the Galaxy one.
Pratt.
Wow.
Pratt, yeah.
That is definitely a unique Chris
list. Well, what's your Chris list?
Chris Evans and then everybody else. Obviously. No,
that's the correct answer. And
yeah, he's good.
Chris Evans with the beard, cap with the beard.
Oh my gosh!
And then
it doesn't matter.
I do like a beard, but yeah. Anyway, so there was a lot going wrong with it. I don't want to go into any more spoilers, and I'm very disappointed because I think we saw it at home, so I'm surprised because I surprised myself at how much I liked the first one. I wasn't expecting to like it that much. And how brilliant I considered the first one, and then I'm really surprised to find this one very lackluster.
Yeah, so your hopes were too high.
My hopes weren't too high. My hopes were at the level that the first one gave me, which is appropriate that I would have the same hopes for the second one then.
This film did not even meet our... It didn't meet our high expectations, but it also didn't meet our what would have been low expectations. It set the bar really low. I think I'm going to say... Look, and there's things to like in this. There's things I did like in this. But the I'm going to pick up on Kathy's reference to Michelle Pfeiffer and in Batman Returns, because I think that's a good reference. Because this film, to me, has more in common with the DC of, like, the 80s and 90s, like the Tim Burton's and Joel Schumacher's of the world, than it does to Zack Snyder's. And I actually think... I liked that about the film. The film's really campy and... Like isn't and where's it the sort of over the top sort of hero vibes on its it's very open about that. It kind of doubles down on what it did in the first one about just having like heroic heroes, which I felt like we all needed, right, with Wonder Woman after the sort of dour Batman and Superman and Man of Steel, and just like, oh, the world is so heavy on my shoulders, and here's Wonder Woman. It was just like a breath of fresh air, and I feel like this sequel really doubled down on that because it's colorful and glossy and fun. It's almost like the Richard Donner sort of Superman vibes, you know. It's just like, this is a proper hero. She's out. It opens in like she's doing proper superhero work, saving people from petty criminals.
And she's never dressed as Wonder Woman though. In the whole movie.
She's rarely in this 2.5 hour schlagfest. I'm kind of with both of you in that, and I agree with you, Amon, that it's the first 15 minutes of this. I was really on board. I'm like, I really loved the opening. I loved the sort of our intro to 1984 and Wonder Woman, and then when the sort of plot kicks in, it's just like, we'll talk about it in spoiler street. It's just kind of just like there's a lot of setup. There's like an hour plus of setup, and then it just, the third act just goes boom boom boom, now this is happening and now we've got to get here really fast. So it's like the thing is like a snail's pace for ages with no stakes. Like there was no stakes.
There was a dildo
was very important. There was a crystal dildo which is massively important in this,
and that's it,
and that's kind of it. And it's just a lot of the first hour and a half of this movie is, what is the crystal dildo? And then it's just kind of, it's all go, go, go from there. And the other thing about this movie for me was that it was really stupid. And I'm okay with kind of stupid, silly, nonsensical plot. But I need something else to cling to. And there was no emotional connection here because I thought there was, for some reason, the chemistry between Gal Gadot and Chris Pine has disappeared from the first movie. And also the comedy didn't really land, and I know that's subjective, but for me, I didn't laugh as much as I wanted to.
I laughed here and there for sure. I think Chris Pine is fantastic at humor, and I love how he plays a fish out of water. He's a fish out of water on this film, and there's a bit where there's a montage where Diana sort of takes him to this sort of space sort of museum and to check out sort of planes and stuff like that, which obviously he's very, very into. And that sequence is great. There's a bit where he's going down the escalator and he's looking at it wide-eyed and so happy and that sort of thing. And that made me laugh. That was really, really good. But to your point about the plot, this is a film that does not do exposition well, because it feels like... Many times when it's doing exposition, the whole entire film has to slow down, and that has to solely be what that scene is about, and then the film can progress. And I think that is a problem for me. I also, whilst I appreciated the spirit behind it, I typically like my messages in films to be a little bit more subtle than what this film is going for, and I think that's by design. But when you're speechifying the movie's themes to me repeatedly, it loses the impact on me. And we'll get to it in the spoilers section, but the final action beats I found very underwhelming. And while I do think that Kristen Wiig is very, very good in the role, she is very underserved by the final 20 minutes or so, which really bummed me out. Because and I get the whole sort of, you know, thread of Wonder Woman beating her enemies not through fisticuffs but through sort of the power of words and, you know, belief and all that sort of stuff, and I get that, and that heart that sort of comes through. But, you know, you advertised that big Wonder Woman cheetah fight for a reason. You know, that is what big part of what people want to come and see with these movies. And again, we'll get into more detail on it in a second, but that was the really, my heart sank in that moment, because that's something which I really wanted to see. I also think Cheetah as the origin that they give her in this movie, knowing what I know about Cheetah in the comics and what and where they go with that, it didn't quite work for me. I actually think this movie would have been better if they only had one villain. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff like that which has me mixed on it, which is again a big shame.
Okay, well let's hold that thought, because we are not familiar with that character, so we'd like to hear a bit about what you're referring to.
Yeah, so she was completely new to us. We didn't know what was going to happen.
We're not big comic people, but let's throw to spoiler street right now. So spoiler warning now for Wonder Woman 1984. You have been warned. Let's get into the detail. So where do you want to start, guys? Because I actually got so much I want to pose as a question, because I'm confused.
Well, I want to know firstly, though, before kind of less spoilery, but like, Amon, what did you think of the 1984 setting? Like, do you think it added anything to the movie?
Yeah, no, I liked what they did with the 1980s setting. I liked that they clearly took that to heart in many respects, but didn't sort of belabor the point. Like, you didn't hear like a whole sort of 1980s soundtrack, for instance, but because it was still recognizably 1980s, and I did sort of enjoy the little touches that they put in regards to that. Again, that scene where Diana takes Steve on this little trip, and, you know, she sees like the break dancing in the corner and that sort of thing. That made me chuckle. And, you know, I was sort of, I mean, technically I was born in the 80s, I'm 1989. But yeah, I'm more of a 90s kid, but it was still sort of, you know, nice to sort of see, the sort of 80s touches in there for sure.
I was born the year this film is set, so it's deeply personal.
Well, Ireland would have been exactly like America in 1984.
It was exactly like it. It was just pictures of Ireland running through. Well, hang on, we got it. Sorry, while we're talking about Ireland and the Irish, there's a throwaway line in this movie, in the montage at the end, when everybody's wishes are coming true. It's like suddenly cuts to some cafe owner in what I assume to be somewhere in England, who just offhandedly says, "I wish you all, you Irish bastards, would go back to where you came from." And then cut to the police showing up and rounding Irish people into vans. And I was just like, what's happening?
I mean, no, it would have been peak IRA.
Yeah, no,
but
I know.
But it also felt very inappropriate. And then the Irish guy goes, "Well, I wish you were dead."
Yeah.
It's just like, I admired their ambition that the writers at this moment were like, right, we're going to have a montage of people having wishes. Let's make this heavy. Let's get the Northern Ireland Troubles in here, the IRA. How long do we have to do this? Oh, we've got about 5-6 seconds. I'm pretty sure we can contextualize all of that. Very quickly.
And the actor has to have red hair. He's Irish. Yeah, that was ridiculous. But I thought the 1980s setting was like, I like it, but I feel like I'm being a bit cheated, because I feel like filmmakers are like trying to make me associate it with positive things. Like, you know, sometimes with nostalgia, you feel like you're being a bit manipulated. But I also appreciate they needed to set it quite distantly from the Justice League we know now, because time must have passed for her. But also, it's like, we just saw the first movie. Right, we didn't. We saw it a few years ago. But the last we've seen of her is like, Chris Pine's basically just died. And then we see maybe 20 minutes before he's alive in this. It's like, we haven't missed him as an audience. It felt completely unearned to me when he came back. Like, I felt like nearly the whole movie she should have been pining for him. Then we finally
pining for him.
We finally
thank you. I've been Dave Corkery.
Because it's like, even when she gets him, right? Like, if I was to imagine that my love Dave was dead for
thank
what
God, it's
60
me.
Years, right? You've just come back. Firstly, we'd probably spend a few days on our own together. Like, they immediately...
That's what they do. They go to
this dude's flat instead of her flat. I don't know why they go there. And then they say they have one night together. They get up first thing the next morning, get out and leave and go to, like, a space museum, like, a train. It's like... Like, and they're just all, like, witty banter. It's like, no, he died and you've lived 60 years alone and celibate and, like...
You just want them to hang around this dude's house all day.
Like, I want them to hang bunking. Around her house, bunking.
I think the bigger issue when it comes to the return of Chris Pine, an actor who I really, really like and who is really, really good in this film, is how he's essentially wearing another man's body.
And yes!
They don't seem bothered by it at any point. That is a problem.
It is a problem.
And also, that guy just shows up at the end and is just, like, fine. He's just, like, as in, he seems to be a pretty fine, well-adjusted person, despite having either a memory of everything that's happened or complete, like, holes in his memory for several days. And, like, what, there's just going to be, like, let's face it, like, there's going to be, like, loads of things in his apartment will have moved around. All his clothes will probably be out from the fashion montage. Yep. Like, that man will be screwed up for a long time.
Yeah.
Where was he?
But I also thought, like, what's the... And I often have had this question about Quantum Leap. What's the consent here? Like, you're having sex with his body, but Chris Pine's inside it. Like, it's actually really fucked up. Like, I don't know. I appreciate they wanted to bring Chris Pine back and they're trying to figure out how to do it, but I'm on it. Do you know did this happen in the comics? Because it's really weird.
Oh, I don't know. Not in any of the comics that I've read. So, yeah, I would need to research that and give you a definitive answer, but right now, I don't know. It is weird that it's just not addressed. Like, I can appreciate that, you know, in a comic book movie, some magical, nonsensical stuff might happen and we just have to go with it. And for a while, so I did kind of go with it. But to not address it is not true to the character of Wonder Woman as we understand her. She is heroic. She would, you know, address it to a point and, you know, try and figure out what is going on with that in mind, rather than try and figure out what is going on just in pertaining to whether or not she's going to lose her love again. So that was a problem.
Exactly. Sure. The Wonder Woman I know would bring that man back to her own apartment to bunk him and not go to his apartment. It's not the heroic move.
But you're right. Yeah, she'd no moral question. Like, she just undid her wish so that... Pedro Pascal wouldn't win. She didn't undo her... Or so that she get her own strength back. She didn't undo the wish because she was like, we've stolen this man's life from him.
I heard that. Yeah, well, look, I think we could talk about this forever, but let's move on. On the subject of the wishes, right? I had this problem with a few things in this movie. It doesn't really establish any rules. And so to your point about sort of magic, I'm kind of okay. I'll go along with magic, right? So I'm like, yeah, fine. It's wishes. It's magic. It's fine. But I'm like, then Pedro Pascal starts going, give me, you know, he turns himself into the stone, which I thought was a baller wish. I was like, didn't see that coming. I was like, this is cool. And then he starts just going around saying, go on, what do you wish for? Say something. I want your wishes. And he's like, just this hungry genie looking for wishes. And but then he's like doing the thing where he just starts to add like addendums onto their wishes. He's like, so the oil guy, right, goes, you know, oh, I wish you all the success. I wish you had all the oil. And he's like, thank you. And he's like, and I'll also take all your security team. And I'll take this ashtray. And it's just like, but wait, you're making wishes now? I don't understand. And towards the end, then it's very much like, yes, but also when you give a wish, when you make a wish, it takes something from you. And I'm like, so wait, you're adding this in now with 20 minutes to go. And that's what he's been doing the whole time. And then suddenly everyone knows to renounce their wishes as if, and Wonder Woman, very explicitly, Diana just like, there's no mention of this in any of the Mayan shaman text that they stumble on in the third act from a guy who has a leaflet.
The guy with the flyer explained it.
That's also another problem of this film.
That's bad screenwriting. That's just like... Sorry, go on.
Not that it's a bad screenwriting, but they... I mean, when it comes to representation in this film and stereotypes, this film is not good. And I believe that the guy who was playing the mind, they just like had a guy with like dreadlocks there, and that there's a honestly that conversation could take up a whole nother podcast, but it's not good. There's definitely some things which people did not think about the way they should have for this movie, and given everything that this movie does do for representation, that's a shame that, you know, more attention wasn't paid to stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's smacks of laziness. And I mean that scene itself smacks of laziness. It's just like we need to get from here to there. So literally this happens, like Kristen Wiig's just like, hey, I'm out of ideas, but I found a leaflet. And then it just happens to be the guy. And there's no mention in that book of like, you need to renounce your wish, but she knows that, she just says it out loud as if it's, you know, I renounce my wish, as if she knows that's going to work. And it does work.
Yeah.
But I'm just like, and she doesn't even check that Chris Pine is gone, and the wish is, she just, do you know what I mean? She's running away from
it. That's what I mean. They're good, but like Chris Pine and her are like supposedly back together after like 70 years, albeit it's been mere moments to him. She has like very obviously been celibate and alone for 70 years. And then it's like, she just says goodbye to him and walks away. Like, I didn't even cry. Like, I'd cry at anything. There was no weight in their goodbye. And I almost feel like they shouldn't. I appreciate they want to bring Chris Pine back. He's brilliant. He's a movie star. He actually shouldn't have been in this movie because they, it was just, it was so wasted. I feel like if we'd waited in like, and in the next Justice League movie or in the next Wonder Woman movie, they finally got him back and we had seen her really missing him.
Yeah.
It would have meant something to me, but it meant nothing to me. And like, the first day they're back together, they're doing the silly fashion montages, and it's like, I just don't, I didn't feel it, even though I laughed at some of it. And it's like, but I'm interested to know what you think, Amon. Like, I know you mentioned like the big set piece at the end, because from home, it looks really, really hokey. And like, on our relatively small TV, Kristen Wiig looked like it. She just looked very badly CGI'd when she became like the full cheetah.
It looked bad on an IMAX screen too, as well, Kathy. My goodness. there's so much about that final action beat which really annoys me. Because one, you know, it's the big action fight scene, and the CGI on Cheetah is poor. But also the Wonder Woman armor. You spent however many months marketing this thing, and she's in it for all of 2.3 seconds, one.
Yeah.
Two, there's no story impetus for her to go and get the armor in that moment, because now she's learned how to fly, so she doesn't need the wings for it. Two, she's got her powers back, and she could take anyone, like she's been taking anyone and everyone throughout this entire DCEU, not, you know, just this movie, but anytime Wonder Woman's at full strength, basically nobody else has a chance. There's no story impetus for her to go and grab that armor before going to where Max Lord is. There's just none. Because she doesn't know that Cheetah has, you know, transformed at that point. She doesn't know. So that was really frustrating. Because if you're going to sort of put all that energy into, you know, teasing this thing, you want it to have a really big impact. And she does, well, two things with it. And I think there's a bunch of, like, guys sort of guarding the complex, and she sort of takes them out pretty simply. She does her big sort of move with her band braces. But again,
the X Factor thing.
Yeah. The X Factor, I like it. She should steal that from you. No. but yeah, this is not something which she needs the armor specifically to do. And at that point, she does not know that Cheetah has transformed. So there's no story impetus beyond the fact that this armor looks cool. We've been teasing it for so long. Here it is for 2.3 seconds, and then it's done. And that, for me, was a frustration.
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I mean, I think it's just another example of this plot, this screenplay just filled with things that don't necessarily have a reason to be there or move the plot along. It's just filled with stuff. And the first hour and a half of this movie has no... Diana has no motive beyond bonking Chris Pine and finding out what the crystal dildo is. And she's not even that bothered about that because... Right?
Because she got her boyfriend back.
Yeah. And and then the two of them are like suddenly just like, oh, we need to go to Egypt now. And they're like, well, why? And then
it's like, what are they portraying over there as well? It's like this crazy view of like what whoever made this movie thinks Egypt is.
That felt just very out of the box Arab 101. Didn't feel like they paid much attention to the culture there either.
Yeah, there's another big mistake when it comes to stereotypes of representation, which is a big shame. But yeah, that Egypt sequence is really weird. I get that, you know, they want to shoot a big action sequence there. But again, in terms of actual story movement, the only thing that happens is that this guy gets a few more henchmen. That is it.
Yeah.
Well, a wall comes up.
And like, you know, you've taken the amount of story time that takes is substantial. And it shifts the entire focus away from the US. They're flying back and forth. It's unnecessary.
Again,
it speaks to your point about the story being messy. They needed to streamline this thing and make it a lot more uncomplicated. They do that by a better story, and they do that, I think, again, by having one less villain. Splitting those duties, I think, is part of the problem. It makes it
more complicated and convoluted. That action scene did contain one of my favorite tropes in action cinema, is when, particularly superhero movies, when two characters are able to communicate a very, very complex maneuver to each other merely by a glance or saying each other's name. So there's a moment in this movie where Chris Pine, in the middle of this Raiders of the Lost Ark convoy action scene in Egypt, Chris Pine just... they're in trouble, and then Chris Pine like takes a missile launcher from one of the trucks, points it in the air, and then looks to Diana and says the word Diana, and then fires the missile, and she instantly knows to lasso the missile and then gets catapulted like whatever 100 feet to save some children who've wandered into the road. And I'm just like, that is true love,
basically. And the children on the road as well is just like, oh,
I think they're trying to do the same thing they did in the first movie when it comes to the shield maneuver, but it doesn't work as well. I mean, it works as well, but in terms of, you know, the story point, as you say, in terms of the simpatico, they take it to another level with that move. You know what? The rule of cool, I'm going to give that a pass, because the rule of cool does apply there, and. That is a good move, so I'll give it that.
Same.
I'll also say that for all the issues that I have with that sequence, the score in that sequence is awesome. Like, it is the best rendition of the Wonder Woman theme ever, I think. When she sort of, you know, leaves the car, and then you get that shot of Wonder Woman running, and it goes...
Like,
okay, here we go. Yeah, that got me pumped in IMAX, I'm not going to lie.
That was cool.
That is good.
So I'll give it that.
Did Hans Zimmer make that for the Justice League, and then he didn't do the first Wonder Woman, did he? And he's come back. Have I got that right?
That is correct. Did he do her theme? The first Wonder Woman was composed by Rupert Gregson-Williams, and that is a fantastic score. It's one that I really, really enjoyed. And here's something I'm going to say. You know, I really liked what Rupert Gregson-Williams scores, I said, and Hans Zimmer is one of my favorite composers of all time. They should not be doing these movies. Women composers should be doing these movies. And it's a shame that, you know, obviously I'm a big fan of Patty Jenkins. And I think she's an incredible woman and an inspiration in many regards. But she should be pulling women composers into this. She should be using her clout, especially when the clout that she had on this movie, to do that. Because there's not many women composers, there's not many women composers composing big blockbuster films. And, you know, one of the things that Captain Marvel got right is that they got a woman to compose it, Pinar Toprak, and it was a fantastic score. And that is the first sort of, you know, major superhero blockbuster that a woman has scored, I believe. We should not still be having those kinds of firsts in 2021. And it's a shame that this landmark movie, Wonder Woman, not one of, the biggest women superhero in the world, has not had that same representation, at least in the composer field across either movies, either movie. I think that's a shame.
Yeah.
Plus, as good as Hans Zimmer is, it does feel like Hans Zimmer is scoring every movie that comes out now.
I mean, there has been a backlog of stuff, so I'll give it that. But my goodness, he's got this, he's got Dune, he's got No Time to Die, he's got Space Jam 2.
He's got
Space Jam 2.
The guy is working. He is working. It is what it is. I mean, I'm not going to complain too much because, again, Hans Zimmer was the guy who opened my ears to what film scores can do. That Gladiator score is such a monumental thing to me.
It was on Channel 5 the other night, and I just sat down flicking past, and I watched the whole thing because that score is beautiful.
It's my favorite score of all time. We can't stop talking about it because obviously if we start talking about it now, this is going to become a Gladiator podcast. That's shit.
I'm with you guys. Like, everyone, it holds up 21 years later. It's an amazing
Dave
film.
Dave watched it on Channel 5 with ads. Like,
I watched it with ads. And I was just like, I'm sticking around for this.
It's so good.
Look, lads, I'd love to listen to a Gladiator podcast for you guys a different time. But there's so much to talk about this movie, but I think we kind of need to wrap it up because Aman's been very kind and recording very late with us.
Yes, thank you, Aman.
Annoying people who are like, can you do it when our kids are in bed? should we talk just a little bit about the ending, the post-credit sequence? But briefly, I wanted to talk about like the ending, which you touched on, Dave, which is like...
the monologue. Monologue.
She bumps in... No, I'm not even going to go there. The scene with her and Pedro Pascal was just a fucking mess when she's talking to TV and everyone in the world's listening and he's like, son is talking to him. It actually doesn't warrant speaking about how bad that scene was.
Can I just say one thing on it?
I'd love to see it in IMAX because I imagine it looked shocking.
I presume, Aman, that's what you were referring to earlier when you were talking about the theme of the movie being delivered in dialogue. Exactly. And
we're like, who's she talking to?
But also the dialogue was really made no little sense, I thought. And I just couldn't stop thinking about the people receiving that message. So you're just in your kitchen, like listening to the radio or watching TV or whatever. Then this dude comes on and says, you can have anything you want. And you just offhandedly say, jeez, I wish I had a really sharper knife right now. And then it's just like, oh, there it is. And then 2 minutes later, this woman with a strange accent comes on and starts like harping on for about a minute and a half about like truth and the real thing. And then suddenly I go, I renounce my wish.
Yes.
Like, what?
That's exactly right.
It's a tricky, tricky thing because I do appreciate the fact that Wonder Woman doesn't typically solve problems with her fists, and that's something that we need more of in superhero media, especially in the DCEU. But I just prefer my messaging in movies to be more subtle. And while I do appreciate the sincerity and the heart behind that message and behind that scene, and it's honestly too hard. It's honestly hard to stay too mad at the movie, which has that level of sincerity, especially after the 4 years we've just had. By the way, the Trump-esque ways they the Trump, you know, homages they are doing in this film, signaling, you know, who this guy is meant to be, you know, doing it's very on the nose, my goodness. But yeah, like, it's hard to stay too mad at a movie which is that sincere. But it's a tricky thing because, like, we live in a very cynical world, and I don't think the world of Wonder Woman 1984 is essentially sort of, you know, it's a much different world to our world in that regard, if that makes sense. And I get what it was going for, and I, you know, it's hard to look at it in a non-cynical way, I guess. Because of the cheesiness of it and the way that it's delivered, which is why I say that I prefer my messaging to be more subtle, because I do think it has more of an impact that way. They elected to go in a much different way, and more power to them, but I think it only half works because of just my preference.
And it's just messy. Like, it looked a mess. It was a mess. It was, I found the ending so messy. And then when it all wraps up and, like, Pedro Pascal gets back to his very cute son. It's like, I was like, okay, I didn't quite understand. Was everything resolved then? Like, were all the wishes undone?
That,
like,
that was unclear. And yeah, that frustrated me too. I do
and
think.
Is he, like, arrested? Can you be arrested for, like, becoming a magical dindo? What's his crime? What crime did he commit? Like,
that's it. I don't. That's it, Kathy. Book him under becoming a magical dindo. I would love to. Like, we need to see the Wonder Woman 1984 cut, which has that scene at the end of the, in the post credit scene. Looking about what's he arrested for becoming a magical dildo. Somebody make that movie. I was just going to say, I will say that, and again, this is why I say the world that Wonder Woman 1984 exists in may be a bit different to ours, because I think that the movie is positing that sort of after, now that this has all been resolved, everything's going to go back to normal, everything's going to be good again. And you know, as we're, you know, if you mirror that, if you look at that and look at the real world, that is not what's going to happen. Like, even though things are hopefully going to start getting better once Trump is out of here, which is thankfully happening, if not already happened by the time this has gone up, what he has stoked over the past 4 years is not going to go away anytime soon. Yeah. This is not just like, you know, things happen, you know, things get better and everything's fine again. This is not that in the real world. And I think that is a sort of the message that Wonder Woman 1984 is trying to pilot, which leads me to believe that the world that the movie is taking place in is much, much, much different from ours, even though there are, of course, similarities. If that makes sense.
Unless Trump renounces his wish on the way out.
I mean, there would be a lot if he truly stood up and ask for forgiveness and renounce his sins. It will never happen. And then right at the end, it's like suddenly, I don't know if you've seen Christmas on the Square, the Dolly Parton movie, but it suddenly turned into Christmas on the Square, like beat by beat.
Oh yeah. It's just suddenly, she's just like, oh yeah. So the theme of the movie, Diana's arc is like, basically she needs to
learn to love again.
Yeah. Chris Pine lets her go and she needs to live life, because the opening of the movie is her eating alone and looking very sad, and then the end of this movie is her still being alone, but looking happy, and staring at children in the snow.
And at men that she's had sex with, but they don't remember that they had sex with her.
Oh god, you're right, it's so creepy!
But anyway, on the square, it's like, there's an old, like, kind of lady beggar, and people are around her, and then the way the set's done is like, beat by beat, the end of Christmas on the Square, which astounded me.
Yeah.
But then the post-credits scene, in fairness to it, I did like to see. I love Linda Carter, so I was really pleased about that.
That was cool.
And the fact that she had been the woman that they very offhandedly talked about, and I wish they spent a bit more time talking about the original warrior who came to Earth and remained hidden.
Mm-hmm.
That was cool. And the armor's hers. But, like, they could have done more with that.
I imagine they're going to do more of that in Wonder Woman 3, which has been fast-tracked by Warner Brothers. But I think people, the point we're trying to make here is that this movie was good, but it could have been better.
Yeah, exactly.
It's disappointing. I think, I've been very negative, but largely I just like to, I have fun picking apart
stuff.
But
it's just middle of the road, and the problem is it shouldn't have been, because it was the shining beacon of the DC universe, and they just, they blew that now. Like, I'll be very cautious going into the next movie. I'll still go, but
exactly.
They've blown it for me a bit, and
I think we all were
on a pedestal.
We all wanted this movie to be better, right?
And they had enough time. I mean, the release was continually delayed. Like, you know, you could have fixed some of this in the edit. Like, you really could have.
Okay, final question for everyone then. What do you want the sequel to be? What's the title of it? For me, it's Wonder Woman 1999.
Okay. I think they're not going to go by year again.
I've already discussed this. I want the movie which Kathy sort of posited about, you know, what happened to Pedro Pascal's character. How did he get arrested?
You want the dildo trial. You want a whole... It's a courtroom drama. A few good dildos.
Magic is happening in this podcast right now. Warner Brothers, are you listening? Pay us our monies. Make this movie.
That sounds awesome. I just wanted to be Diana...
I don't want Chris Pine back again, and I really love the actor, but
he's not coming back.
He adds nothing.
Well, they would undo her whole arc in this movie.
It pisses me off. Like, I know I keep banging on about it, but I actually feel like they brought Chris Pine back in because of that age-old lie that a woman can't lead a movie, and they felt like we can't do this without Chris Pine. It pissed me off. Next time, I just want Linda Carter and Gal Gadot, and just, like, rocking it out together.
I will say this, like, this is part of the reason why, you know, I think I love the Themyscira bits in both this movie and the last movie, but Wonder Woman should be interacted with more women in these films. Yeah, yeah. And if they can figure out a way to get her back to Themyscira, or to have more Themyscirians come and join her in the real world, I think that would make a boatload of difference to the quality of the movie.
That'd be amazing. And I because, think Patty, you know, Jenkins, don't write it.
Because one of the things which... we don't have time to get into now, but one of the things which bothered me about the movie as well is that in making so much of Diana's sort of screen time about being with Steve, we don't really get enough of just Diana herself and developing that character on her lonesome without Steve helping her out at every turn, not only in this movie but also in the last movie as well. So with Wonder Woman 3, I would hope that they really sort of make that the singular focus, have her interacting with more women, simplify the storyline, simplify the storyline and streamline things. Mm-hmm. And I think that will lead to a better movie. Fingers crossed.
I agree. I agree. And I think we don't get enough of development work on Diana. And that's what we want and need. The woman, the movie's called Wonder Woman. And she's been around between these two movies for 60 years. And all we get is like a picture of her standing in front of a ranch from a few years ago. Like, what's she been doing? Like, give us something more, movie.
Yeah. Okay, we need to wrap it up. We're going to go offline together and develop a few good dildos. The three of us are going to write that screenplay. But in the meantime, Aman, thank you so much for staying up late to do this with us. And tell our listeners where they can find more of your work.
Yeah, so I'm on Twitter at @awoman. You can follow me there and find all my work there. I am a contributing editor at Empire Magazine. I'm also a monthly columnist at Empire Magazine. So you can read all my work there. The next issue of Empire Magazine may already be out by the time this comes out, but it is, and you can't miss it. Like, we've got 40 amazing, famous people to jot down their amazing cinema experiences, and I can't wait to read that. Like, we've got the likes of Chris Evans, Edgar Wright, Daisy Ridley. There's some, like, if you look at the newsstand cover, which is amazing, the artwork is amazing, then you get a flavor of who's going to be in there. It's amazing. I've got a big feature there in this issue of magazine called, for Judas and the Black Messiah, which is a film that everyone should be really excited to see. It's fantastic, and I spoke to the director Shaka King and the Keith Stanfield for that. And I've got a couple of other bits and bobs in there as well. If you follow me on Twitter at @awoman, I'll be posting all the good stuff, so you can just do that.
Cool. And weren't you just like casually on a Zoom with Viola Davis the other night?
Yeah, she's my bestie. You know, exchange numbers.
I was so jealous when I saw that.
Yeah, that was cool. She is a queen. I did a BAFTA Q&A for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which is on Netflix right now. You should see it if you haven't already. It's fantastic. And she is fantastic in it.
Yeah.
She was on very, very good form in that Q&A. So it's good.
That's amazing. And then you have to do this. I'm sorry, such a fall from grace. But next time, hopefully, we'll see you in person. We'll actually go for a walk, go for a drink, go for a movie, do it the right way.
I want that voucher.
So thank you.
Oh, yes. Yes, yeah, we definitely owe you a voucher.
We owe you a very strong drink.
One free drink and extended dildo chat, courtesy of the cinema.
Okay.
Can't say no to them.
Thank you so much. Oh, thank and we need guys. To say for anyone who hasn't already done so, if you haven't already rated us and subscribed to us wherever you listen to podcasts, please do. And we're on all the social medias at The Cinemile.
Yes.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening, and thanks,
Bye.
Aman.
You know, I'm not so keen on this one. I figure you are, but you know what? I'm ready to go. I think we can do better.
Parachute pants?
Yeah.
Does everybody parachute now?
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
What would you say if I told you there's a book that can teach you how to win The Bachelor?
What would you say if I told you producers caught multiple finalists reading that book in this season that's currently airing?
What would you say if I told you the producers don't want anyone to know that their show has been compromised?
How do we know all this? We wrote that book.
I'm Lizzie Pace.
And I'm Chad Colchin.
We're the authors of How to Win the Bachelor and the hosts of the Game of Roses podcast, a bi-weekly podcast where we break down all the biggest plays, errors, and MVPs in the game of reality television.
Listen to Game of Roses wherever you get your podcasts and go to howtowinthebachelor.com to get our book.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.